Welcome to the RFP Success Show with host Lisa Rehurick, the number one sought-after authority on RFP success. Each week, we bring you information, strategies, or resources to help you win more business through RFPs and have a little fun doing it. Let's get this week's episode started.
Welcome, everybody, to the RFP Success Show. I am your host, Lisa Rehurick, founder and CEO of the RFP Success Company. So welcome back to part two of my conversation with AJ Patel, talking about strategy, competition, and industry trends. Last week, we covered mostly strategy and competition, and today we're going to move forward with talking about industry trends and also professionalism. So welcome back, and AJ, welcome back. I'm just going to go ahead and jump right in.
So the other conversation that we're kind of going to move into, and you touched on it a little bit here with the competition, is just the industry in general. I really was fascinated by what you had to say because you've been in the proposal industry longer than I have, and it was interesting to hear your take on how the industry has evolved since you've been in the industry. And I want you to share that with our listeners as well. How it hasn't evolved, I guess I should say.
Yeah. Well, why don't we first kind of give a historical context of how it has evolved? And I think I'd love to talk about the future, where I think some of the things we should think about as a professionalist community about the future. So, and I don't know how many people know this historical context, but I'm going to go all the way back to 1940.
Nice. I like it. I don't know that.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, today we have these best practices and they're great. They actually had really early origin. So in 1940, an author by the name of Nelson wrote an interesting, it's more of a monograph, called Writing the Technical Report.
Okay. Oh,
interesting. This is, and I mean, we've all known, you know, in literature, you know, and those of us that paid attention in English class about thesis sentences, right?
That was not me.
That was really kind of, yeah, okay. So it's really kind of the first time there was a focus about thinking about thesis sentences from the perspective of what we do as proposals. I think that the next big advance was, and some of your listeners may be familiar with this, it's called STOP, the STOP method. It's, gosh, what does STOP stand? I think it's about a sequential topical organization of proposals. I think I may have that, I think that's right, by an individual by the name of Tracy. And I think that was more of a white paper that they had developed. And it was probably a really significant advancement because it started to think about, how do you think about proposals as something being modular? How do you think about text versus graphics? How do you think about thematic unity within the different modules? Oh, important one, how do you think about page count allocations?
Oh.
So important.
Don't even get me started on that one.
yeah. Otherwise, it just becomes a technical report that you edit your way down, right? To get this, which is really hard.
Yeah.
Storyboard. So this is, if, for your listeners who don't have it, I'm happy to, I think I have a copy that I can provide it, okay, or I can get to you, Lisa.
Awesome.
So it introduced a lot of the things that today we think of as just, wow, you know, they're just standard parts of what's good, good and best practice. I think Tracy was at Hughes. And then in the 60s and 70s, while there were a number of folks, Jim Beveridge really comes to mind. He was another Hughes. I think he was in BD at Hughes. He wrote two books. They're hard to get. One is called The Anatomy of a Win, and the other is called Creating Superior Proposals. This is where he started to introduce the idea. So this is where it became, it's not a technical report. It's a sales document now. Okay. And so, and we have to kind of, as we all know, it's really both, right?
Yeah.
And so this is when I think we started to think about as best practices, first person, active voice, nothing superfluous, discriminators. Oh, the idea of ghosting your competitors, I think, was something that Jim Beveridge wrote about.
Interesting.
Benefits, not features. Yeah. So the things that today we all kind of say, well, yeah, of course, that's what we do, right?
Yeah. Obvious now.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think what really happened is the 80s has kind of kept on going along. It wasn't really until, and I think that was kind of the formative years for two individuals in particular, three actually, Steve Myers, Steve Shipley, and we'll say High Silver. And when I look back, I see those three individuals as being absolutely pivotal individuals in terms of very significant advancement in our profession. And it's really a kind of, how do we reduce this to a process from an art form? And then how do we ultimately codify into command media? And all three of those individuals had significant contributions to that. And I think I want to give credit to APMP, because then it was really about how do we understand what the best practices are right around this. So I think it was really the 80s and 90s. Well, it was the 80s when those three individuals I mentioned really started to formulate the ideas. It was the 90s when it became a reality. And then it was really the late 90s and the 2000s when that really got then reduced to best practices. So that's kind of the historical context.
That's really fun. And let me just interject here real quick, because I know I've got listeners on here that are not proposal professionals. And so APMP, what APMP stands for is Association of Proposal Management Professionals. It's our industry association, and they set the standards. They've had a certification, and they've been around since...
The late 1990s. Yeah.
I know that the Valley of the Sun, which is where I live in Phoenix, it was the first chapter, the association. So, and I think that was somewhere in the 90s. So you're right. Anyway, I wanted to give that context to people who might not know APMP.
All right. You want to talk about the future?
Yeah, let's talk about the future. And I want to know too, AJ, like, who do you see as you kind of go through this conversation about the future? Can you talk to us also about who sets these trends? Like, who is the leading, you know, you mentioned some people that kind of have been influential in the past. How do, you know, who do we look to now for the trends?
Oh, good question. You know, I think there's certainly a number of notable individuals that have been in our profession, are in our profession today. I think ideas are originated by individuals, right? But I think it's really more today, it's about the community, frankly.
Agreed.
So I think it's about how the community starts to, as a group, starts to kind of reexamine what we do as a profession that will really help us move the profession along and evolve it. Mm-hmm. I think this is a good time because, frankly, I don't think we really haven't, maybe as a community, we haven't had the courage to reexamine our beliefs. I know all the companies I work with, they have significantly evolved in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Incredibly evolved. Their markets evolved. And so I think we need to rethink some of the fundamental tenets of what we do in terms of what a proposal really entails as well.
I'm not sure. You think that starts with the RFP itself?
Well, the RFPs kind of tend to evolve very slowly. There certainly have been some very interesting RFPs that I think we've all seen, you know, in our practices, changes in how the customers are actually doing their evaluation, to changes in how they're actually are thinking about what the submission is. We're involved in a healthcare competition right now where the proposal is submitted in Excel.
Oh, I know. I hate those so much. I can't even tell you.
Yeah. And it's not like you're not sending anything that's reduced or simplified. It's the full complexity of what you might otherwise typically, you know, do a desktop publishing job in Word or Adobe.
Yeah. Oh, that's brutal. That's not where we want to. Yeah. We do not want to evolve to Excel.
Right. You can understand their intent, right? But yeah. I think we've all seen some interesting things around the RFP. You know, that evolves a bit slowly. You know what those three individuals did in the 90s, Steve Myers, Steve Shipley, and High Silver, they actually, and I've personally been involved in a number of cases where the customers come back and said, wow, we haven't seen anyone else do something like this. This is incredible. And so I think us in this profession also have a responsibility to help move our customers' thinking, the evaluators' thinking along in terms of how they're evaluating these proposals. So I think we may have lost a bit of that courage as a community, and I think we need to regain it a little bit. So I think this is a good time for us to kind of critically examine our processes, our tenants, things like that. And so there's a handful of areas, I think, which I'm certainly excited about in terms of how we're thinking about things and where I think the community at large should as well. So, one of them we chatted about is about strategy. So if you think about what has occurred historically, the proposal development process was really an art form until these three individuals kind of came along and realized that it could be reduced to a process and best practices, which in fact can be trained. People can be trained on these things and where you can get predictable outcomes, right, as a result. Right. And I think we should think about how we think about the strategy part of this process in the same way. It's still very much of an art form. So I think there's a lot that we can do in terms of trying to create some best practices around, trying to reduce it to maybe not one process, but at least some principles and frameworks. And you know, what made that possible, at least my belief, is that implicit understanding that the proposal development process is really a journey of discovery. I mean, we rarely start a proposal and not make significant changes, you know, along the way, right? Yeah. It's literally a journey of discovery. I view the strategy aspect of it in the same way that it's really a journey of discovery as well. I think if we're open to that, we can actually start to think about how to kind of take the strategy aspect of this and also take it to the same degree of maturity. So I think that's certainly one of the things which I would like to see us do as a community. And I think actually will start to occur because it's, you know, winning business, it's become incredibly harder as the years go by, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So there's a couple of other areas, I think, which we should reexamine. Well, let's talk about graphics.
Yes.
So visual literacy. Okay, let's just start with, we all commonly accept today that there's some best practices around graphics, the incorporation of graphics into proposals. And I'm not saying that that's bad at all.
Right.
I'm just saying that we should actually take another look at this because let's just think about this, right? When we were all kids in school, we were discouraged from reading comic books.
That's true.
We were discouraged from absorbing information through graphics.
Oh, that's
now if you're an artist in art school, fantastic, right? But for the rest of us, trying to interpret something from a graphic, we just weren't taught how to do it, and I don't think we still are. So I think there's this whole unexplored aspect of visual literacy. I kind of call it. So if you think about it, originally graphics. So if you think about those three guys. And High Silver was all about cover art, but Steve and the two Steves were, you know, more about the actual content of the proposal and how to make it more readable, right. Reduce opportunity for interpretive errors, those sorts of things, by using graphics. And the way I think originally, you know, they really thought about it was that the graphics were used to illustrate the text. And then over time, I think today, really great proposals, we kind of take it to where the text is used to narrate the graphics in kind of a way. So it's kind of this getting the right balance between the two. I kind of call it persuasion on the cheap. It's really, really hard for us to write great, compelling text. Maybe easier for us to come up with a piece of art that we think will help explain what we're offering. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't convey the complexity that only narrative can convey. So it's kind of we're cheating a little bit by this persuasion on the cheap a bit. So I think this is an open area. I don't have any answers for it, but it's something that we should really kind of think about, visual literacy. I mean, today, the vast majority of the information that we receive is through images. I mean, think I just read the other day where now the dominant social media channel is Instagram.
Yeah.
It's not Facebook. It's not LinkedIn. It's not any of those others, right? Or it's Instagram. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, I do think, you know, as the new generations come up, that is huge. And I very seldom see graphics done well in a proposal. I mean, obviously when you hire professionals to do that and all of that, but, you know, again, kind of in the market that we work with, you know, because to your point, we're not taught how to consume the information off of a graphic, but we're certainly not taught how to create a graphic that sends the right message. And I see graphics time and time again that have way too much information or very nebulous information. You're like, I don't even understand what this is trying to convey. And I think we think as long as we put it in there, it's going to look good and it's going to make our proposal look more professional. It's like, well,
right.
Not for
exactly.
Nothing.
Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. And I at least my perspective is it's really harder to write a great couple paragraphs of text than it is for, you know, me to sketch out a potential piece of art for a proposal.
Yeah, it probably depends on how your mind works, right? But again, we've got to think about the reader and how is the reader going to consume that information best. Probably a combination, but I agree that needs to evolve. What do you think about technology and artificial intelligence in the RFP world?
Oh, wow. So technology-wise, that was, you know, kind of probably one of the single most pivotal things that made all of our jobs easier and also harder at the same time in the starting the mid-1990s through the last, you know, decade and a half, right?
Yep.
AI, I hadn't even thought about that. I think, wow, if maybe there's more applications for AI on the evaluator side than there is for us. I don't know.
I love that answer because people ask me this all the time and I'm like, I don't even, I don't know. I don't see the applicability of AI on the RFP side, but that's interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, think about what most of us practice. It's what we practice today is what we've learned mostly experientially, not through pedagogical learning.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you replace experiential learning with AI? Well, I don't know. But I could see some, you know, that same customer that's looking for an Excel spreadsheet for the proposal. I could potentially see them 5 years from now using some AI algorithm to select a winner.
Yeah, true. That's true. Hadn't thought about it from that perspective, but that's so true.
Yeah. That's a little scary, actually. So I think so. Okay. So I don't think we've actually thought about visual literacy. I mean, we understand, you know, kind of the importance of graphics, but we really haven't thought about visual literacy. So I think that the second area, and this I think might be provocative for many of your listeners, I don't know. I think it's actually time for us to reevaluate the role of narrative. So the text and proposal. So the text is sometimes really the only good way you can convey nuance and complexity. And so we've kind of gotten out of touch with that sometimes. So I'll give a little bit of, so there's numerous books on how to write well, right? Yep. Classic books, all going back to Fowler and Strunk and Wright. Interesting enough, there's only a handful of books, and this is kind of the other side of writing, that are actually about reading.
Oh, interesting.
And so there is one great book I'd recommend to your listeners. It's called, it's titled How to Read a Book.
What a great title.
It is. And I think a lot of people have mistaken it as kind of, you know, it's a book you buy so that you can help your third grader to read more effectively.
Yep.
It's really more of an academic book. It's by Adler and Van Doren. So Adler, Mortimer Adler, I think, was the original founder of the Aspen Institute. For your listeners who know what they are, you know, they're one of those nonprofit institutes that ideas, right?
Yep.
And so I want to talk a little bit about that actually book. And so it describes four levels of reading, and this actually translates back to us kind of rethinking this art of the narrative. It describes four levels of reading. It describes an elementary level, an inspectional level, an analytic level, and a synoptical level. So if you think about how we apply that to our profession, the way I relate it is that inspectional level is really about, it's about producing a compliant proposal. It's making writing in a way where the reader, the evaluator, can easily assess that you're in compliance. So they're going to, you know, your evaluator is going to inspect, essentially read the proposal at an inspectional level to really assess if you're submitted a compliant proposal. The analytic level is where we're convincing the reader of our claims. So every proposal is comprised of claims, right? Now we'd like to back those up with actual actions and choices and, you know, features and benefits, right? But it's really about, you know, why is it that, you know, this particular key performance parameter is, you know, 20% above threshold objective or threshold requirement, or it, you know, it's at the objective level. So the analytic level is really kind of producing that narrowing about the data and relating it to, you know, an evaluatable factor in the proposal. Now the synoptical level is that level of reading which you're comparing across documents or proposals in our case. It's really done on the concept of themes and big ideas. It's about, you know, making, hey, make the award to me as the most compelling award, right?
Yep.
So this is an interesting book that actually talks about kind of the underlying aspects of how people read at those four levels. And I think it's at least for me, it's been useful.
I think that's fascinating. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about a lot is that we, meaning human nature, is for us to approach things the way that we are. And if we stop and think about the behavioral styles of the people on the other end of that proposal and what is it that they need, it seems very simplistic, right? But it's very hard to write that way. But I love this because this is really about how does the reader read? And then we need to be, to your point, our narratives need to be focused on that, not on
exactly
us and in our own heads, which is how we approach it generally.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of where my original interest was. Well, if you really want to think about, you know, how we should be rethinking, you know, essentially the fundamental tenets of what we do as a profession, right? let's start with how the evaluators evaluate, and let's just start with the role fundamental, which is how do they read?
Right. Well, and you know, it was funny. I was doing another podcast interview earlier today, and we were talking about that. You know, these poor evaluators, they're reading minimum 3 probably proposals up to maybe 7 proposals. And if you're 5th or 6th or 7th, man, you better have a pretty compelling proposal, or that person's going to be doing their grocery list in their head. There's just no way.
Oh my goodness. So let's talk about the evaluators, right? So first of all, this is their second. They have a day job already, right?
Right, exactly.
This is their second job usually. So what we need to be thinking about is we need to give them some relief from boredom. We want to give them something exciting to read.
Yes.
And I think, you know, another couple of other interesting aspects of this is, well, I think there are some great studies, psychological studies, or some academic studies done way back when, that essentially concluded that our mental capacity for processing information at most is 7 ± 2. It's like 2.5 bits. Okay. I don't know if you ever heard anyone say that. I think if you see on those magic shows, plate spinners, they can only spin 7 plates at a time. Everyone's going to try to do 8, just can't make it happen.
That's interesting.
Related to that, right?
Okay.
And I think, you know, since this is their second job, I mean, so what we want the readers to, first of all, have greater knowledge transfer, right? So we have to figure out a way to simplify things so that we can transfer all this knowledge to them when their capacity for processing is limited to 2.5 bits. We want to give them a higher level of understanding. We want to give them some relief from boredom. We want them to retain, you know, longer retention, right? Because at some point they're going to have to kind of rethink their scores and summarize their scores. And most important, fewer interpretive errors, right? So this is about putting the burden of reasoning on the writer, not the reader.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, no wonder. I can only imagine that these evaluators are essentially, you know, what's the first thing they're thinking? They're probably skeptics. They've probably got some cynicism.
Yeah.
Maybe some lassitude, right? Really don't care.
Yep.
Worse yet, probably has a little bit of derision as their attitude going into these. Now, I'm maybe being a bit extreme, but I think.
But it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that you're being that extreme. I mean, any evaluators that I talk to are like, oh my gosh, please tell your clients to not bore us, or tell your clients to answer the questions, or, you know, some of those things. I love talking to people that evaluate and review on a regular basis, but it's true. I don't want to, you know, if we think about it, we don't even want to read the RFP, right? The RFP.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Just because the RFP is boring does not mean we need to write boring. So let's make it a little bit.
I mean, right. If you really want to be honest with ourselves, we should ask everybody on the proposal team. So have you actually read every word in the RFP?
Right. No way. And you know, there's no way they have. That's hilarious.
Right. So I have some ideas on this.
Okay,
but
good.
Before I offer them to your listeners, I just remembered, let's get back to visual literacy for a second.
Okay.
There's one, you see, I love to read, right? So there's one book which I just found incredibly fascinating. It's the only book I've seen which actually, in an interesting way, talks about visual literacy. The author is Scott McCloud, McCloud. And the title is Understanding Comics, The Invisible Art.
Hmm. Interesting.
Now, it's actually written as a graphic novel.
Okay. Very interesting.
It's a fascinating book. Anyway, so now getting back to narrative. So I think I have a suggestion for us as a community. So we're talking about nonfiction storytelling, essentially.
Right.
And, you know, and what we're talking about are basically, you know, of models for how to communicate, which, you know, basically, you know, how to persuade, how to engage the reader more effectively, and how to share information, right? So I think, and there's really no good body of knowledge around this. We did some considerable kind of literature search and digging. I actually spoke to professors at different English departments.
Wow.
About this. And we kind of concluded as kind of 5 basic models of nonfiction story writing. I'll quickly kind of take, if you like, happy to take kind of your readers through these 5 models. I think what we need to think about is how do we take, because other industries absolutely rely on storytelling.
Yep,
right?
Absolutely.
And so how can we take what they've refined and think about applying it to what we do in proposals? In some cases, it may not be particularly applicable, but I think just thinking through this will be helpful. So the first one is what we've labeled as the iconic social science argument. It's a trajectory. I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with the book called The Clash of Civilizations. By Samuel Huntington. It's one of these big idea books.
Okay.
It's been around for a while. But the social science argument essentially goes along this process. And then this is the model for essentially writing, is the narrative. It's, what, first of all, you know, you basically pose, what's the question or problem I'm trying to solve? And then you kind of talk about, where does the question come from? And then what's your hypothesized answer? How do we arrive at that answer? And then kind of like the so what? You know, if your answer is correct, you know, what else of interest might happen? So that's one model of writing. Okay. The second one is, I think probably almost everyone has heard of The World is Flat book by Thomas Friedman.
Absolutely.
Former reporter. So it's he actually employed what I would call the medical rounds approach to narrative storytelling, which is where you present a snapshot. And then you do what is actually known in literature as SOAP, where you do the subjective, then you do the objective considerations, then you do the assessment, and then you do the plan, right? So it's like a diagnosis type approach. So I think, you know, there are particular aspects of what we do in proposals where that's definitely relevant to. A third is another book, which is fairly well known, Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. He's written a number of other books as well. And that's more of a inductive reasoning path. It's you start with data points and then you go to generalizations. There's no necessary theory that's underlying it or guiding principle, but the story emerges from the details. The more data, the better. Now that is probably actually where the vast majority of technical volumes are written using that style. I think, and let's say that is the right style, right? Narrative style for a technical volume or for the specific technical volume we're writing. I think it's useful for us as professionals to actually understand more about how that inductive reasoning path really takes place, how the readers actually are taken through that journey. There's the opposite, which is kind of Freud's approach, which is a deductive reasoning path. You start with theory, then you develop an hypothesis. So it's where the big story generates expectations about what we're going to see in the world, and then the details follow from that. And the more kind of creative or generative that theory is and precise that theory is, the better results you get. And I've actually been involved in some proposals where that approach was used, probably much more so in a management volume than other volumes. And yeah, the last model, you kind of see where there's these parallels in terms of how I'm describing these. The last model is really interesting. And this actually could be an interesting area of competitive advantage for companies that can kind of really figure out how to capture this aspect into our proposals. It's more of an ethnographic approach. It's a deep narrative. It's maybe obscure for some of your listeners, maybe not others. It's Out of Africa by Asek Denison. It's a truly deep narrative, embedded storytelling. A storyteller puts himself or herself in the position of the subject. And this is where you're trying to capture the culture, essentially. It's more, you know, it's more important than explaining causality or other aspects. It's really about, it's about who you are as a company, for example, right?
Yeah.
Or firm. And you know, that would, I think, would be a great approach to thinking about executive summaries.
I agree.
Or your cover letter.
Yeah, for example. Absolutely.
So we've kind of reduced it down to five. There could be more that we just haven't encountered or thought deeply enough, but I think, you know, one of the things thinking in the future around how we can advance our profession is actually thinking a bit more deeply about, hey, there's actually more to this than what we're just typically doing when we sit down and start a proposal and start writing.
Right. And it's true, because if you do just sit down, you know, to kind of earlier conversation we were having and just start writing and don't think about all of this, it's, you know, you're just going to blend in and likelihood of winning is a lot less.
Yeah. So, I'm so glad you said that, because, wow. I mean, here's my history from the 80s, right? It's that, and really maybe more so in the 90s, is that back in the 90s, even a flawed strategy that was beautifully executed in the proposal through graphics and everything else, and where even though it's a flawed strategy, it was executed well in terms of actually pushing through the themes and the disclaimers through it, right?
Yep.
That oftentimes won.
Right.
Only because the reader had a much better time evaluating the proposal. Today, I don't think that's the case. I think today, not only do you actually have to have a winning strategy, you also have to figure out how to tell that. You have to execute that in the proposal well. Yeah.
agree.
So I think there's a third, maybe it's the third or fourth, I can't quite recall area in terms of thinking about the future, which is kind of around professionalism.
Yes. Yeah. And it was interesting when we were having this conversation, because you were talking about, you brought this up and I had not really even thought about it in that context. So I think this is fascinating. I think the listeners will be definitely interested. So give us your thoughts on, you know, because you worked for a large professional services firm back in the day, not that long ago, actually.
For two, actually. Yeah. And at SMA, this is my version 2.0 at SMA. And then also at TRW for many years. So I've kind of seen a lot of different cultures, and certainly the two large professional services firms, you know, large global strategy companies, right? Which was revealing in many ways in terms of professionalism for me. So I think, you know, my interests are you know, largely because I had that context, but in thinking about how to think about from our, you know, what we do, right? I think, please, I hope your listeners don't take me as trying to be, as being pejorative of any of us, right? Or us as a group, but
right.
I don't think we've matured yet to the same level. So this arises largely because we are still a relatively young trade craft. I mean, if you think about the law profession, accounting profession, other professions, those have matured over centuries.
Right. So we're relatively new.
We are absolutely relatively new. And I think the other aspect that kind of, I think, is another trigger to kind of think about this for the future is that this is also largely an accidental profession for us. We don't go to school for it, right? We aren't necessarily taught how to behave or what is our code, right?
Yeah.
As professionals. So I think the way I still describe it, and this is where I please, listeners, don't interpret this as being pejorative, but I think many of us, even myself, we oftentimes think of ourselves as hired guns, whether even you're a full-time employed at a company or you're a consultant, right, consulting to that company. We still think of ourselves largely as hired guns because what we do is intense, it's project-based, it's up, you know, draft RFP just hit the street, RFP hit the street, now we know we've got 60 to 80 hours a week looking forward to that, right? So, but we're here to get it done, right?
Yep.
We've got a hard deadline when it's got to get done. And oftentimes, you know, we're asked to essentially try to drive the organizations to doing hard things. So we think of ourselves as hard guns, I think. And I think while there's some really good examples about that, there's also some very limiting aspects of it. So I think we should actually start to think about what professionalism means in our tradecraft and profession. I think it's not necessarily code of behavior or ethics. It's really, look, we all understand procurement integrity and all those things, right? I think this is really more, and this is, I'm sorry, it's hard to be concrete, get your arms around, but it's really more predominantly an attitude. It's not about competencies. It's, and we focused on competencies in the last 20 years. I think this is more around attitude about, it's not a label we give ourselves. It's a label that we want others to describe us as true professionals. And I don't know, maybe the shortcut way for me to kind of describe how I think about it is that it's essentially an unqualified dedication to excellence in serving our clients and their needs. And the definition of clients is actually pretty expansive. So it's other people you work with in your company, as well as the, you know, your company's clients, right? And so, and then also it's finally kind of the other aspect of this is how we treat each other's professionals and not be tolerant of anything else. We've all been involved in proposals where, let's say as a consultant to the company, where, you know, hey, it was a tough process, right? But you don't want the fact that it was a really tough process, intense hours, to then have the client say, hey, I love these guys coming in as consultants, but I would never work with them again because he made me do hard things, right? So I think we need to help other companies, as a consulting firm, we need to help other companies actually help them get to that right answer, the right decision, help them produce a winning proposal. And even though it's hard work, still have it as a productive, constructive, and enjoyable experience.
That I find, and I wonder if you see this too, is that there's still a lot of people that don't respect the efforts of the proposal team. And it blows my mind because you've got this huge piece of business, this huge sale that is in the arms of your proposal team, yet you treat your proposal team as if they're second-class citizens. And so there's a professionalism there, in my opinion, as well, from the respect level of the people that do this kind of work.
Absolutely. We still see it today. And it's unfortunate. I think it's only going to shift with continued education, continued, you know, us as a group exhibiting professionalism to the leadership in those companies. I won't give specific names. One of the top tier one defense platform companies, very close to, you know, the considerable amount of work, which also directly involved the CEO of that company. This company culture was a culture where they truly honored program management over engineering and BD. And then I'll include proposal professionals in the BD organization, right?
Yep.
And the CEO recognized this, that that wasn't the right answer for the company's future. And so from the CEO down, they had a commitment to really kind of understanding how do they can actually ennoble, you know, the other disciplines in the company so that it was honored and invested in, and that other people understood what they did. And so that was a great engagement for us, and was a great example of how I think, you know, we should start to see other companies recognize that this is important what we do.
Yeah.
And we work in the crucible. I mean, it's intense work. It's hard. There's nothing routine about it or easy. Oh, everyone's reviewing our work, not just the end customer, but
true. Right? Yep.
And all right, that, hey, out there, the outcomes usually you win or you lose, right? So whether you did that proposal as well as you can, the outcome's going to reflect on us, right?
Yeah.
So it's tough. I mean, it's a tough profession to choose. There's lots of emotion, heated discussion. Oh, lots of personality.
Lots of personality.
Individuals, yeah. There's a lot of opportunity for behavior that's not productive, or even sometimes becomes a barrier to winning. So we've all experienced it in another. So I'm sure we, if you think about it hard enough, we've all have exhibited some of these behaviors as well. So
yes.
I think, you know, what I'd like to see us think about as communities is how do we, now we've done a lot of work in the last 20 years on competency and skills and process and tradecraft. It'd be interesting for us to engage in a conversation writ large about professionalism. And we think about ourselves as a profession.
Yeah, no, so, I agree with you. And even leadership in this industry, because I think we focus on competencies of the hands-on proposal team, but I don't know that we've done as good of a job at focusing on competencies of leaders, people that are leading the proposal teams in whatever capacity.
No, that's true. Yeah, it's true. I think that is an unexplored area as well. And, you know, that kind of taps into a much broader literature and understanding around leadership. You know, one of the things that we've done at SMA, and this is kind of where SMA started, I had the benefit of being SMA 1.0 very early years with Steve, is we've actually started to focus more on hiring for attitude. You know, sure that the folks we hire have a requisite set of skills, but being willing to invest in filling the gaps on the skills and competencies.
Yep.
So and this attitude is kind of more directly related to, you know, our views of professionalism.
Yes. I love that. And I think that's so important. And then too, building the culture around, you know, mm-hmm. one of the things I talk about too is like, you got to have a culture of RFP responding, right? Versus winning and losing. I mean, obviously winning is important, but it's got to have, it just goes back to that supportive respect that I talked about and everything that you've been talking about. You've got to have the right culture. This is not just a second class group of people that are, you know, magically come in the middle of the night and create your RFP response for you. This is the crux of your business. This is the nuts and bolts of business, which is revenue generation, right? This is sales.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'd like to get on that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So if we overly focus on winning and losing, even though that's the outcome, that actually is a kind of a reinforcing behavior around guns for hire.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And that's not where we want to be. Yep.
I agree. Wow, AJ, well, this has been such fantastic conversation, and we could probably keep talking for another hour, which I think we discovered on our first phone call.
Yes. Yep.
I really appreciate you being here. If people want to connect with you and your company, what is the best way to do that?
Very easy. We're very open here, so people can directly shoot me an email or give me a ring. So my email is aj.patel@smawins.com. And my number is 949-975-1550, extension 7100.
Wonderful. And all that information will be in the show notes. So for you listeners, if you were frantically trying to write that down and you didn't get it, don't worry. It's in the show notes. And AJ, thank you again so much for being here. I greatly appreciate your insight. It's been a great conversation.
Oh, you're welcome. This was truly delightful. Thank you, Lisa.
Wonderful. All right, everybody. Thank you for being here. Again, you've been listening to the RFP Success Show, and we look forward to having you back again next week.
You have been listening to the RFP Success Show with RFP expert Lisa Rehurick, author of the RFP Success Book. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, make sure you click the subscribe button so you don't miss a show. And thanks for spending time with us today.